Nine Easy Dreams. How does a relationship end? One day, it's just better to be alone. Or put it this way, it's easier for her to be by herself than it is for her to be with you. She doesn't say so in so many words. It could happen like this. She comes home one day, walks down the narrow stairs to the living room and finds you on the sofa watching television. I got offered a job, she says. That's great, I didn't know you were applying for a job. Who with? What job? Team leader. Oh, excellent. Who with? Liverpool City Council. Wow, are we moving to Liverpool? No, she says, I'm moving to Liverpool. The rest is just organisation, dividing everything into two and taking the stubborn remainder to the dump. Making copies of holiday photos and putting them into identical new albums. Buying cardboard boxes and filling them up, taping the flaps shut. Occasional tears, but mostly being very civilised, very repressed, very English. Calling the landlord and giving notice. Utility bills, forwarding addresses. One final meal together, promising to stay in touch. Turning out the lights and closing the door for the last time. After that, you take long walks along the seafront by yourself, west to Worthing, east to Newhaven, stride along the cliffs, pick your way across the chalky rocks and gravelly sand, letting the wind blow into your face and hollow the water right out of your eyes so that you can pretend it isn't tears. You drink till early in the morning, drink from early in the morning, drink with friends and drink alone, drink, go to bed drunk and wake up drunk, turn up at work drunk and nearly get sacked. You have bad and meaningless sex with strangers you meet at other people's weddings. Try to sleep with your friends and get painfully rebuffed. You suffer bursts of violent misogyny, hate every woman in the world, and spasms of self-pity, hate yourself. And you give up smoking. One Saturday, I woke up and forgot to have a cigarette. I forgot until about lunchtime, remembered, and then still didn't have one. I ate a tin of beans and sausages on toast and didn't have a cigarette after that. It felt like a little experiment. How long can a smoker go without a cigarette? I was a committed smoker. I once saw the artist Maggie Hambling on George Melly's afternoon art quiz show, Gallery. She lost a point for failing to recognise a fragment of the Paolozzi murals in Tottenham Court Road tube station, and in her defence remarked that she hadn't been on the underground since they banned smoking. That was after the King's Cross fire, but you could still smoke on television then, and Maggie Hambling did. She was my kind of smoker. Let me elaborate. I went out with a girl once. It was quite a serious thing for both of us. She wanted me to give up smoking, and I wanted to give up smoking for her, so I did. While drinking with her, after eating with her, after having sex with her, I managed not to smoke. She discovered a packet of cigarettes under my bed one evening and was outraged to learn that when I wasn't with her, I still smoked. What difference could it make, I asked. For her, I was a non-smoker. However much time I spent with her, even if we moved in together, even if we were married, I would refrain from smoking while I was with her. But there would always be moments when I wasn't with her, and then I would smoke. I cleaned my teeth, my clothes. How could the smoke harm her? My disappointment in her failure to understand was overwhelming, and that was the end of something quite promising. I had a cup of coffee, no cigarette. Went for a walk outside, no cigarette. Called a friend, went to the pub, drank a pint, no cigarette. I pulled the packet out of my pocket and looked at it dumbly. It was like seeing an old friend and suddenly realising that you had nothing in common after all. Amazing. I drank three more pints. I walked home, no cigarette. None the next day. I wondered if in the division of things she'd accidentally taken with her my desire to smoke. It became a week in which I drank and talked and worked like usual, a week in which I did everything that I normally do, except smoking. I walked up Elm Grove to see a girl, and instead of air rushing into my lungs in painful bursts, it started to flow in and out in rhythm. I was a pair of bellows. I set my pace to 120% and arrived sweating, pink-faced. "You've stopped smoking," she said. "I have," I replied. "That's great. Are you on the gum?" "Nope." "Patches," I shrugged. "Willpower?" "I guess. I'm not really trying to do this. It just happened." "I'm impressed," she said. After 2 weeks, it got tough, but by then I got used to the idea that I was giving up smoking, and so I really did apply some willpower. I gave the duty freeze away. I took the ashtrays to the charity shop. I ceremonially dropped the lighters from the top of a car park at midnight to hear them burst with a pop on the ground below. I got the gum, I got the patches, and I gave up smoking. I had a phone call from Liverpool. "How are things up there?" "You know, busy. It always is when you start somewhere new. There's nothing new here. Do you miss me?" "Well, it's just different." "Got anyone else?" "Well, not exactly." "Oh, not exactly." "And you?" "Well, not exactly either, a few times." "Guess what?"
"What?"
"I stopped smoking."
"You're kidding me."
"Nope, 3 weeks now." Oh, well done. Yeah, I sort of didn't want to. That's pretty good, though. Yeah, do you reckon you'll be back in Brighton anytime soon? Might be, I've got to pick some stuff up. Well, we could have a drink. Yeah, we could have a drink, but not a cigarette, eh? No. What's life like after you give up smoking? It's exactly the same. You wear the same suit to work in the same stupid office with your retarded co-workers, but the suit doesn't smell of smoke anymore. You spend slightly longer on your tea break to make up for not having a smoking break. You do everything you used to do, only without the accompanying fag. It's strange how little energy smoking actually takes up. And then maybe you buy some trainers, go for a little run, actually turn up and play football with workmates instead of promising to. Cycle for fun, cycle to work even if it looks like it might rain in the afternoon. Rediscover your vitality. There is a Chinese encyclopedia in which it is written that all cigarettes fall into the following categories. Cigarettes that belong to you, cigarettes that belong to someone else, cigarettes that have already been smoked, cigarettes of regret, foreign cigarettes, first cigarettes of the day, cigarettes smoked after sex, cigarettes bought in pubs, and cigarettes that appear in dreams. At first, I didn't even realise I was doing it. I don't keep a track of dreams as such. I don't wake up and write them down. Sometimes a powerful dream puts me in a daze for the day, but that's usually the kind of dream involving unspeakably lewd acts with a co-worker. When I woke up one morning with the inexplicable image of a silver Zippo that I used to own in my head, I realised all my recent dreams had one thing in common. There was the prison dream. I'd done something terrible, something I would regret for the rest of my life, killed someone or worse, and as I sat alone in my cell waiting for the verdict or the executioner or my mother to come and shake her head at me through the plexiglass, as I shivered in fear and waited for my cellmate to return and rape me, I hungrily sucked on a cigarette. There was the school exams dream. Revision time was up and I hadn't been to any classes, hadn't done the work I should have done, especially the maths, the bloody maths. If I didn't pass the exams, I'd have to do them again, or I would never get a chance to do them again, or somebody else would have to do them for me. And I stood outside the exam hall, waiting for the doors to open, hand cupped around a cigarette behind my back, one eye beady for the sight of a teacher. There was the naked dream. Walking through Churchill Square without pants, climbing out of the sea onto the pebbles without trunks before a bank holiday crowd, sitting at my desk suddenly without a stitch. And in all these situations, without having pockets to put a packet or a lighter in, I was frantically trying to relieve my anxiety with a cigarette. There was the other kind of naked dream that involved a cigarette, sometimes afterwards, sometimes during, sometimes a cigarette that was part of me. Even when I dreamt of being a child, back at the big old house in Putney where we lived before Dad died, the one with the tall stairs that I couldn't climb till I was three, when I was wondering whether there were some extra rooms that Mum had hidden from me somewhere because I'd been bad, or which room my sick dad was in, my chubby little fist found itself with all five fingers wrapped around a burning cigarette. Damn. At first, I wasn't bothered. The rational mind's not responsible for its dreams. That's why when you dream about another girl instead of your girlfriend, it's not technically cheating, not even the same as deliberately looking at other girls in the street, because it's not your responsibility, right? You can't help what you dream, it's not your fault. So it was okay. If I smoked in dreams, it wasn't like smoking in real life. It wouldn't physically harm me. And for a while, I just enjoyed smoking in the dreams. I'd go to sleep happily anticipating a night of risk-free smoking and wake up a happy man. No cough, no phlegm, no worries. Sometimes, when I was alone, I'd even go to bed early, a little guiltily, in anticipation. And then I started coughing in my dreams. Not coughing in my sleep. I checked. Was I coughing all last night? No, you snored a bit, but that's normal. Not even a little bit. Not at all. Why? But I couldn't explain that though my lungs felt fine in the morning, I knew that I'd spent the night nursing a hacking cough, an irritating, painful cough, a cough that felt attached to my diaphragm, one that I could perhaps only fully satisfy by turning myself inside out. I wondered if perhaps I ought to stop smoking while I was asleep, but I didn't. Regardless of the cough, in each dream, from the dirty ones to the ones that woke me screaming, there the beacon was, a burning ember attached to the cigarette in my hand. And then, one single vivid real dream, so clear I thought it must be lucid, that I had some kind of control and at the same time inevitable, a movie script. I was in a long featureless corridor. It might have been an office or the headquarters of a secret police organisation. The windowless doors along the corridor were closed and numbered in a sequence beginning in the thousands. Walking down the corridor, I knew I was alone as I could be, and yet the presence of thousands of other ghostly people was imminent. Every cubic inch of space was full of them. At the end of the corridor, so far away as to be barely visible, getting hardly any nearer as I walked towards it, was the door that I knew was mine, the door to which I belonged. When I got to it, the handle was stiff and the frame slightly warped. With an effort, I opened it and stepped into a small yellowing room lit by a bare bulb, occupied by an elderly, gnome-like man sitting behind a desk who had a tangible air of unpleasant authority. "Your results are here," he said. "Results?" I asked. "This wasn't an exam dream." "The results of your tests."
"My tests?"
"The results," he said, "of the tests that we have performed upon you. They are here." Understanding flooded into me, a warm glow of embarrassment. These were medical tests of some kind. I was here to collect the results. I wanted to sit down, but there was no seat opposite the gnome's desk, and I remained standing. The gnome seemed oblivious to my towering over him. I noticed that I wasn't smoking and suddenly needed a cigarette. I couldn't make one appear. "The results," he said, "of the tests which we performed upon you, which we now have," waving a sheaf of papers in my direction, "are, I'm afraid, not good." He allowed a moment. "You have lung cancer." The whole world suddenly became very cold and still. "It may be possible to operate," said the gnome, his breath condensing on the air in the office. "It may not." Bare of shelves, cabinets, or any furniture other than the desk behind me, which the gnome sat, the room started to become larger. The door was no longer behind me. It was no longer anywhere. I knew for certain that behind where the door had been, a battalion of fat anaesthetists and surgeons equipped with high-tech scalpels were trying to enter to operate on me, to remove this horrible excrescence. "It is quite advanced," said the gnome from inside me, breathing with my lungs, sucking air into himself, growing quite large. The room was very small again. No desk, just me and the gnome. He coughed, I coughed. "I'm truly very sorry to have to give you this news," I said. I woke up with a taste of sick in my mouth, already crawling through the bedroom door, and then I was throwing up violently, my knotted stomach kicking against my ribs. I brushed my teeth and crawled back to bed. "Are you okay?" she mumbled, still half asleep. "A bad dream," I said. "I think I ate something." She reached her arm across me, holding me to her before slipping under again. I spent the rest of the night with my eyes wide open. I didn't die all at once, or rather, the dreams of dying, emphatically not the best dreams I've ever had, came slowly and distinctly overlapping each other. I would wake up with a vague sense of having spent the night in a hospital. Feelings of hopelessness and regret washed over my waking hours at inopportune moments. The prognosis remained bad. I slept with tubes inserted into me, debilitating chemicals running into my blood, cell counts and x-rays, grim doctors and smiling motherly nurses. I split up with the girl. She couldn't see why I was like this, and I couldn't explain. I'm dying in my dreams. And there was one final dream. A dream in which I was and wasn't, an out-of-body dream. I saw them putting a box containing me into the ground and covering it up forever, sealing me away. How can you live without dreams? Nobody asks you what you dreamt about last night in the way they ask you about last night's television. You have to volunteer dreams and volunteer them carefully at that, remembering that it isn't funny to tell someone that you were fucking them senseless in your sleep last night. Dream conversations drift quickly from their topic. There are no arguments to be had, no logical conclusions to draw. You can't be wrong about dreams. And so not dreaming didn't really make any difference to day-to-day life at all. Our friends who smoke a lot of weed, some of them say they haven't had a dream for years. I think the science says the dope simply stops you remembering the dreams, but I'm sure I was having no dreams at all. How do you put things back together again? Sometimes you don't even have to try. It's as if the parts have been waiting to reassemble themselves, just floating around out there, one jigsaw piece looking for another. I was in the sanctuary one Saturday morning, drinking coffee and making the transition from mild hangover to mild lethargy when she came in and sat down opposite me. We hadn't spoken for a while. "Didn't know you were in town." "Flying visit," she said. "All going well in Liverpool?" "Well, that's the thing. Hey, I'm down here looking for a flat." "Did the job not work out?" "Kind of. Liverpool didn't really work out. I'm not northern enough." "No, serious enough. I'm not serious enough for Liverpool."
"Really?"
"Apparently not." "Well, if you want somewhere to crash while you're..."
"That's okay. I'm staying with friends."
But she smiled. I saw her again, a few times. We had comfort, familiarity. We could talk to each other. We slept together. Just once, because I was drunk. We were drunk. Her new flat had 3 a.m. techno-nubbing neighbours upstairs. She spent a few nights at mine. There wasn't ever a point where we said, "Let's get back together, let's do this again." There wasn't a time when we admitted to each other that we'd made a mistake, that we were right for each other.
I still don't know that we are. There was a moment when we went for a drink with some old mutual friends, making it clear that we were together again. That might have been a turning point. Or it might have been when I tried clumsily to explain what happened. "My dreams died," I said. "It's all right, honey," she said. "So did mine." I left it at that. Now when we go to bed, we sleep spoon fashion, my hips against the curve of her back, and I put my arm around her belly. She puts some weight on and I like it. It's something to hold myself around, and I smell her hair as I fall asleep into a deep sleep, a sleep without dreams.